Now we have a long way to go, but there are some things that are much too important to miss. And what we want to get now, just to begin with, is this general situation that seems so confused, this confused situation of battles and so forth, in these chapters following 22, Alma 22. Now, in Alma 22, verses 28 to 34, it makes a very important statement. It's hard to believe that this was written in 1829, because it wasn't until the beginning of the 20th century that the Alfred Mackinder, a Scots geographer, invented geopolitics, which were taken over and which is the basic theory of the two main types of culture that occupy the world and are in constant conflict and so forth. All world wars and so forth have been based on that. And here it is set forth here. We get the picture that the Lamanites are in the southwest and scattered off toward the east. They're pushed in this direction and that direction, and they are being contained by the Nephites, who are in the northeast in general. So you have two general land masses, the one surrounding the other. Well, here we have the in the southwest, all along here are Lamanites, and the main mind body are Nephites, but they're Lamanites over here, and they want to keep their way open in case they can retreat there. Now, these are the two cultures. The one are the culture of the steppes, the heartland, or the Bedou. In the old world, you see all around the center of Asia, Central Asia, is all marginal grass-raising country with nomadic tribes of great antiquity that have always been on the move. And along, of course, all the northern shore of Africa and all of Arabia. See the desert tribes, they're the Bedou, and they live as described here. They all live in tents, all of them, whether it's the yurts of Central Asia or whether it's the vital chakra of the Arab, and they are on the move all the time, and they are all in a state of perpetual war. They're always bringing pressure to bear on the peripheral civilizations, which are the settled civilizations. Of course, you can be the one or the other. They're not doomed to the one or the other. The Arabs, all of a sudden, in the 8th century, became the greatest city builders of them all, just for a very short time. And they preserved this marvelous culture in Spain with the souks and the bazaars and the universities and the libraries and things, a marvelous sort of thing these people can do. But the other culture, of course, is the sedentary. It's a city one, and we still have it in continental and the United States, for example. The Plains Indians, they happen to be to the north and east. We're always pushing on the, and coming down from the north, the Navajos very late, on the Pueblos. Pueblos are people in settled cities. They are like the beginning with the Anasazi, up in the north, which we're really Hopi. Anasazi, Hopi, then the Navajos come in, but then you have much older, you have Taos, and you have Acoma, and great settlements of great antiquity there, under pressure from, and this is exactly what we have in the Book of Mormon. Nobody pointed out these until anthropologists and so forth in the 20th century, especially geographers, pointed out this is the basic pattern that we're going to have in our history. We're going to have the Lamanites, who are essentially, you see, mobile. They move around, but they can have settlements, they always do, and of course the Nephites can also move around, but they're the sedentary, and again, the mobile, those are the two that divide the world and always have. And the battles between them, they keep the pressure on all the time. So it describes it very well, the 28th. They dwelt in tents, they were idle, to us they don't work, they don't cultivate the soil or anything like that, whereas the others work very hard. And then, in Alma 23, you see, the Lamanite king pushes the church. He backs it up and he forces it all. He rules a very large area, you notice. It includes, as we find out over here, the next chapter, beginning the next chapter, he rules the Amalekites and the Amulonites and the Lamanites and the people of Anti-Nephi-Lehi. There were his own people. But the key to this whole thing is that those who were converted at this time were a relatively small group, but very influential. You notice the king of the Lamanites made a proclamation that all the people, all of his people, they should not lay their hands on Ammon or make any trouble, let them do anything they wanted. The brethren were given a carte blanche here. The brethren should go forth and preach in whatsoever place they wanted to. They should have free access to their houses and temples and sanctuaries, everything wide open to the missionaries. That they might be, his people might be convinced concerning the wicked traditions of their fathers, where some aren't going to take that very well because everybody's proud of the traditions of their fathers. And to convince them, he wants to convince what he wants to do. See, it's a glasnost. He wants his people to believe that they're all one people and all one. They've got to bury their differences and so forth. He rules them all. Notice he says in this third verse, that they were all brethren, that they ought not to murder, nor plunder, nor steal, nor commit adultery, as far as that goes. They were all his subjects, as far as that goes. And he consecrated, and so the brethren got busy, Aaron and Ammon and so forth, consecrating priests and teachers throughout the land among the Lamanites, who began accepting the gospel. Thousands were brought to a knowledge, and they were taught the records of the prophecies. And the Lamanites proved the most faithful of them all. We're told in the sixth verse here that many of them joined at that time were rock firm and never again did fall away. For they became a righteous people. They did lay down their weapons. This was before Ammon's people buried theirs, you see. They started doing this. And this is what righteousness means. What is righteousness? They lay down their weapons of their rebellion and did not fight against God, neither against any of their brethren. This, we say, is before Ammon, so this is an interesting thing, the way things are being pushed here. And here's a list of the good Lamanites. You'll notice it's quite a complicated thing here. What do we have here in the 23rd? They include the people of Midoni and in the city of Nephi, and Lamanites of Shillim and Shemlim, and the city of Lemnum and Shimnalom, and so forth. It sounds like the Hopi villages. Their names all sound alike, you know. Shemong, Bishapalavi, and so forth. They sound just like that. That they are laid down the weapons of their rebellion, yea, all their weapons of war, and they were all Lamanites. That all this converted. So the tide has turned now. There's been a very important event that happened. So then what happens? Now the question arises, see, with the 16th verse, do we have a state within a state here? It looks awfully good for the church and so forth, but most of the people were out of it. They didn't like it at all, as we shall soon see. That came to pass that the king was desirous that they might have a name. Not only were they going to be a distinct people, they're going to have a name to set themselves off from the rest of the nation. Well, again, was that a tactful thing to do? Was that a wise thing? Well, they have to have the name anyway, as we read in the 115th section of the Doctrine and Covenants. The name of the church was a very important thing. You have to have a name to distinguish yourself. Nomen est omen. As the Latins say, that's how you... Without a name, you can't be identified, as far as that goes. And we know that in this age of computer, identification is everything. You see, you have to have a name to distinguish you from all other of the like. But would this be disruptive in the state? On the contrary, it was a removal of barriers. It wasn't a setting up of barriers by giving themselves a special name, Anti-Nephi-Lehi, an interesting name, incidentally, we'll get to that. But they were doing the very opposite, because this is what he says here. They began to be industrious people, and they did open a correspondence with everybody here. And cursed the God no more, and the curse of God did no more follow them, excuse me. They're going to tell us again, right across the page here, that what they did was to remove all the barriers. They opened trade to everybody. That's what we call glasnost today, I suppose. They were named Anti-Nephi-Lehi, as you notice. You know what Nephi-Lehi means, a combination of Nephi and Nephi. And anti, of course, means combination, face-to-face, meeting. That's you get Adam on the Ammon. That's one of the richest prepositions we have. You see, this anti means so many things. We get it in the Book of Mormon, a good name, Anti-Omni and things like that. So we get names like Anti. Well, of course, Anti in the Book of Mormon, and you notice the Latin Anti. That means standing in front of a person and facing him. Of course, that's the Greek anti. Anti. And Arabic inda. Inda. Anti, anti. And Old English and swearian. The word answer, for example, is and swearian. Swear back at a person. Swear in Old English. And swearian. And this means face to face, back confrontation, whether it's in Old Norse or Old English, whether it's in Semitic, in Arabic, or whether it's in Greek, whether it's in Latin, or whether it's in the Book of Mormon, it means a face-to-face meeting, a joining together with somebody. So we're going to find later on about an Antichrist. The Antichrist is a person who pretends to be Christ, who matches Christ, who pretends to take the place of Christ. It's not somebody who opposes Christ, but someone who pretends to be Christ. Well, we get that a little later when we get to Korihor. But first, they gave themselves this name of Anti-Nephi-Lehi's, and they were called by his name and were no longer called Lamanites. So they're set apart, but I say still, they began to be an industrious people, getting to work at last. And the Nephites, they did open a correspondence with them, and the curse of God did no more follow. And so we are told here, well then, yes, 23rd verse.
With this gathering of people under Lamoni and they're receiving a new name and so forth, would that be similar to the year festival that you described when we talked about
Benjamin? Oh yes, remember,
Benjamin
it's going to tell us very clearly, the next chapter ends telling us that they came back, when they all returned, it was to the law of Moses, which they observed strictly. And of course, that all centers around the rites and ordinances of the temple, the bringing of the people together, you know, and the renewing of the covenants. They all enter into the covenant again, and they have to come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts. You read that in, say, in the end of Zechariah here. In. Well, then what? Do we have a state within a state? Well, some people thought so. They didn't like it. See, now the next verse, chapter 24, we're going to be real trouble. This 24th chapter is one of the most significant in the Book of Mormon. We never quote it, of course. We like to talk about Captain Moroni and the 2000. We don't like to talk about these pacifist wimps here. And these are the best people in the Book of Mormon. They're doing what the Lord wants them to do. Well, but they didn't like it at all, you see. And they were stirred up, and when they formed this anti-Nephi Lehi, that was just too much for them. And they were stirred up by the Amalekites and the Ammonites to get anybody that wasn't in the combination. And they began to rebel against their king. See, they open revolution. Now they take up arms against him. So they're rebelling, and they're forming a revolution. They're having a revolution against the king and the whole thing. And they're much more numerous than the other people, too. How are they going to handle that, especially since these people aren't inclined to fight back? This is the backlash, you see. It's armed rebellion is what it leads to, as you'd expect it to, after all, considering there's only a number of the people, and the king went so far. I mean, they're just reveling in this new religion, the new name, and everything else they've given themselves. It's not a new religion. And this is going to cause the inevitable backlash. But they're faced with a policy, on the other hand, of non-resistance. This is a strange thing. And that's exactly... Remember that the Ammons people were a relatively small group. But that's what the Hopis practice. See, they practice non-resistance. A very funny thing. Hopi means a peaceful people. So that anybody can take advantage of them, from fool anthropologists to oil companies to uranium companies and so forth. And they're just pushovers for anybody. And you'd think they would have been wiped out long ago. But as the Book of Mormon tells us later on, those that take up arms and oppose, they're the ones that are going to be destroyed. And the Hopis are still there. They're still going strong after everybody, perfectly free to take advantage of them. And don't think people haven't tried to do it. But there actually are people that would refuse to fight, you see, as far as that goes. Now, so how are you going to fight these people? This is an important thing to remember here. What do we got here? So they're... From the 22nd verse on, there's no contest. But this is the reason for it, and this is the most interesting thing. This is why I say this is not a popular chapter. Notice how often they repeat the word murders here. I thank my great God that he's given us a portion of his spirit to soften our hearts, that we have opened a correspondence with these brethren. Notice, opening correspondence with everybody. They're not raising barriers, they're lowering. That's the 8th verse here of this 24th chapter. And we are convinced of our sins and the many murders we have committed. Next verse, it says, talks about the murders. In 11th verse, the many murders. They keep talking about the murders here. They refer to killing on the battlefield. Is that murder? Well, you bet it is. During the recent operations, we've adopted the amazing doctrine, certainly doesn't agree with Clausewitz, that you measure your success in war by body count. You can gain nothing at all. And one of the basic principles of Clausewitz, until the war is over, nobody knows who's going to win, because chance plays a greater part in war than anywhere else, as he says. Nobody knows. It's your game of chess again. You can have all the pieces on the board, and your opponent can have only two left, and he can win. And this happens in time of war. Strange things happen this way. And so they feel guilty. They think what they've been doing is murdering. Then... it was all we could do to repent sufficiently. They can't repent enough. God hath taken away our stains. Let us stain our swords no more with the blood of our brethren. If we should stain them, the atonement would... We can even have a claim on the atonement if we went on doing this sort of killing. It won't do. He's made these... These are mostly Lamanites now talking, you see. He's made these things known unto us. He loveth our souls. They realize the enormity of what they've been doing, you see. He loveth our souls as well as he loveth our children. Therefore, his mercy, he doth visit us by his angels. That's what it takes to turn them around, you see. So, the stains taken away from our swords, let us hide them up as a testimony to God. As a testimony to God. It's interesting, a slogan you often found in Korea. They tell me in Korea and Vietnam, kill a gook for God, you see. Now the gooks have come over here and shown us that they're not gooks at all. They're not smarter than we are as students. Most of them are. We've got a lot of them. But we thought that was virtuous, you see, because we were on the... These chapters of the Book of Mormon are very necessary. Actually, they are. And so Well, we won't talk about Moroni's designs here. Now, brethren, if our brethren seek to destroy us, we'll hide away ourselves. It dwells on this whole rest of the chapter is on the theme of not offering resistance here. See, we have the 22nd verse following. See, there's no contest. This is the change of Lamanite policy, and it was most effective among the pure Lamanites. The others didn't go for it, we're told here. I think it tells us in the... Yes. Now, among those who joined the people of the Lord were none of the Amalekites. They were an important part of the kingdom. And the Amulonites, who were all, well, mostly, overwhelmingly, they were overwhelmingly the other ethnic group, the Amulekites. And none of the order of Nehor were persuaded, and the whole church had been Nehor before, you know. But they were only the actual literal descendants of Laman and Lemuel, the blood of Israel, which certainly implies, you see, that the others, the Ishmaelites and the Amulonites and the Amalekites, were of another stock, actually. But they're so closely related, see, just as they are among the Indians and as we are and so forth. You can't get away from it. After people have once been enlightened, because, you see, they had been enlightened. They came out of Zarahemla, remember that. And then have fallen away, it's worse than ever before. Now, are we missing anything? Oh, yes, here, an interesting thing about this refusing to fight back. In the book of Maccabees, in the fourth book of Maccabees, the same thing happens there. When the Jews, these terrible, bloody stories, you see, that Josephus tells, he's an eyewitness to the sort of thing that went on. But in fourth Maccabees, you see, the Jews are fighting Jews there, and they back up and Antiochus, others. It's the Romans, the Greeks, and then it's the Romans that are torturing them. And they start persecuting the Jews on a massive scale, and the Jews are non-resistant. They're martyrs. They're willing to be martyred. And it immediately dampens all the ardor, because you can't be heroic if the enemy doesn't fight back. You just give up. You're not going to carry on at all. This is no contest. This is no fun at all. And this is what happens here. Notice thus, without meeting any resistance, they did slay 1,005. Well, no contest, no game. People started losing interest there, and this is what happens in 4th Maccabees, I say, when they start aged martyrs, and then they start the seven sons of the widow and so forth. They offer no opposition, and the leaders, it begins to hurt their consciences, it begins to make them sick, the opposite, and as a result, they get mad at these people. Won't you resist? Don't, damn it, why don't you fight? And see, they get mad enough to slaughter them, in other words. It's a paradox here. Because they didn't want to slaughter them, they forced them to do it. Why do you force us to do this dirty thing? This happens another thing in the beginning of the next chapter. Those Lamanites were angry because they had slain their brethren. And it depends on who they is there. But we'll say, and the Lamanites, they stopped fighting then because the others weren't putting up a fight. On various occasions, war tribes have dropped their philosophy, have dropped their ferocity and so forth. They can change very quickly. There's a characteristic of the Indians from being friends to being, from being enemies to being friends, and the other way around. So the Lamanites stopped killing them then, and many whose hearts had swollen for them with their brethren who had fallen under the sword, for they repented of the things which they had done here. And as I say, it takes all the heroics and passion out of it. Clausewitz says there is no hatred in war at all, because you don't know any of the enemy to hate them and so forth. It has to be artificially induced, and that's why you have this... It's used very skillfully in the Book of Mormon by Amalekiah, when he sets up towers and has regular speakers going around. You have to whip up this hatred. You have to make an issue, and you have to grind things, as Clausewitz tells us, and you have to build it up. It's artificially produced. But this is this. Why would they stop fighting so readily? For a very good reason. These were their own people they were fighting. They weren't fighting a traditional enemy. Just a month or so before, they had all been one nation and one people. And moreover, the bounds had been lowered. They had been visiting each other. They knew each other. There's a wonderful passage in the 5th century ambassador to the court of Attila, who goes back to Asia and talks about the same sort of thing. These people knew each other on both sides of the line. They didn't want to fight each other. And so they had been a single nation. They were not a traditional enemy. Since Glasnost, I suppose, they'd known each other. As it tells us in first chapter, those Lamanites were angry because So again, you see, it's not surprising at all that they stopped the slaughter. I mean, if it had been a traditional enemy, it had been somebody else and so forth, but they were all under the same king, remember, their same kingdom. These people are in a state of open rebellion. They're the rebels, you see, but even with the rebels, as far as that goes. And yet, what a bloody thing it can become, as we've seen in the case of our Civil War, the nastiest thing that ever happened, you see. But they went on. They just went on killing as if they were hypnotized. A horrible thing. Well, gaining nothing by it. And so they threw down their weapons. They wouldn't fight anymore. They were stung for the murders they had committed. This was murder they were doing. I mean, when you take life, it's murder, no matter what you call it, as far as that goes. And so more of them were joining the church then than those who were slain. Now, among those who joined the people of the Lord were none of the Amalekites or Amulites. They still remain outside, and they still remain hostile, so we're going to have more war. None of the founders, none of the Nehor people, and that was the main church among them. Only, it says, only the actual descendants of Laman and Lemuel, they were converted and so forth. And then after the people once enlightened, we said that before. Now the Lamanites were angry because they'd slain their brethren. Now this 25th chapter, that may be puzzling because it gets mixed up here. The Lamanites transferred the action to Ammonihah now. That was Ishmael's group, you see. And here's another thing. Remember what the blessing on Ishmael was. These people of Ammonihah, that was the city they're going to wipe out completely. And this was a group of Lamanites, not the Lamanites that had pledged not to fight again, because these were fighting, you see. These were the other Lamanites, their brothers, who were so mad to see the way their brethren had been treated and so forth. They started taking out on the Amalekites and the Amulonites, and they made an example of Ammonihah. But Ishmael, remember what the blessing on Ishmael was when Abraham gave his blessing to Isaac and to Isaac and Ishmael, his two sons, was that his hand should be against all men, and all men's hands should be against him. And of course, that's the Gaza, that's the raid. You're fighting everybody. They're always, the wars are a perpetual state of tribal war among them. You make agreements in tribes, and then somebody breaks it, somebody kills somebody, and there must be vengeance. You're required revenge. This is, honor requires it. You must, so you revenge him, so they have to revenge the one you killed, and this goes on, and then away you go. And this back and forth. Later on, the Book of Mormon lays immense importance on the important on not avenging anything, because once you start that, there is no end, as you see in Ireland, as you see in Lebanon, you see in the Philippines, and so forth, when you have factions that have to get even with each other, because you have to, and each one has a legitimate offense. They've both been wronged, and so forth. So the Lamanites are angry, and they took it out. They went over to Zarahemla and fell on the people of the land of Zarahemla. And the people who were in the land of Ammonihah, see, the lands were divided up into lesser sections, and this was Ammonihah, and they wiped them out. And after that, this led to a general fighting all along the front here. What we find here is the Nephites versus the Lamanites, and the fighting goes on. Ammulon, in the fourth verse, Ammulon takes a beating here. Remember, Ammulon, they were Amulekites. Ammulon was the leader of the priests who were led out by Noah, Noah being the son of Zenoth, Zenoth being a direct descendant of Zarahemla, Zarahemla being a Amulekite. So this is another stock you see here. And the Amulekites went on, they were slain by the hands of the Nephites. It's a free-for-all now. Everybody's fighting everybody. It's just like the wars of the 16th, 17th century. The point being that you'd be on one side one day and another side the next, and this is the way you'd shift back and forth. And the remainder, having fled into the wilderness, now here, the people of Ammulon, slain by the hands, fled into the wilderness, their old hands at that. And they got there by themselves, then they usurped power over the Lamanites they found there, and had an auto da fe, and caused many of the Lamanites to perish because of their belief. See, they moved to the only safe place. If they moved into the territory of the recently converted non-resistant Lamanites, they wouldn't meet him with any trouble. So they just go in there and take over, and they become their usual brutal selves, the Ammulonites. And so, having suffered much loss, they began to be stirred up. Remember the words of Aaron, began to disbelieve the traditions of, see, for many of them, talking about the Lamanites. On a broad front, around the east side here, you find them all also. These general movements take place. You know how that happens. After Ammulon takes a beating, he moves into Lamanite country, and he oppresses the Lamanite non-resistors who had been converted by this general pacifistic trend. And see, these general movements have their trends. There are times when, in this country, when we feel very warlike, very proud, the pride is back and all this sort of thing. And then there are other times when we're much more critical of ourselves and so forth, much inclined to be sober. And so it goes back and forth. The pendulum swings, as you know. And the Lamanites in general react against the arrogant Ammulonites who had moved over them, because the way they treated the non-resistant, the gentle Lamanites now, the other Lamanites got mad at the Ammulites and lit into them. And so we find a perennial feud going on here, a terrible mess. And to this day, and many of their brethren would be stirred up to anger, there began to be contention in the wilderness. The Lamanites began to hunt the seed of Ammon, who've done so much mischief to their more faithful brethren, and hunted them down. To this very day, they're still hunting them down there. So it goes on at the time this was written. Well, the Lamanites, they saw there was going to be a no-win situation. The Lamanites saw they could not overpower the Nephites in the 13th verse here, the 25th chapter. So the conversions are steadily increasing among them, and it says they follow and accept the law of Moses. That's what they were doing. Many of them came over to dwell in the land of Ishmael, the land of Nephi, and joined, see, it's a very mobile period, joined themselves to the people of God, and they were the people of Anti-Nephi-Lehi. They did also bury their weapons, according to their brethren, became a righteous people. And they did keep the law of Moses, look forward to the coming of Christ. The law of Moses was the type, outward performances, but they had to perform them to keep them in mind, keep them informed, preparing, relying upon the spirit of prophecy that the Messiah would come. Now, now we come to this wonderful speech of Ammon's mission report here. It's a very good one here. And it's a most singular document. Look at one is so full of things like this one here. Ammon to his brethren. Now remember, this was the same Ammon who wiped out the forces, who was more than a match for the people at the waters of Sebus. He was a one-man. He was a one-man platoon. He could wipe out anything he wanted. He was the most ferocious fighter, the most effective fighter in the Book of Mormon. And yet, see what kind of a mission he goes on here. The words of Ammon. He says, "Brethren, I will answer for you. For our brethren, the Lamanites, were in darkness, and they to them have been a marvelous light." He says, "Behold, the field was ripe." This is what happened. Miraculous turn. One key figure in all this change, all this going on, the whole movement comes back to this one man, Ammon. So it's very important that he gives a report on his behavior and his motivation and how he was able to do it. And so it's very interesting how one person will start a movement. It would be very like Martin Luther, for example. Make the first move and everything starts rolling like that. And that's what happened here. "For our brethren, the Lamanites, were in darkness, the marvelous light of God. Behold, the field was ripe, and blessed are ye." It was just time to do it. "They thrust in their sickles and did reap. And they shall be gathered together in the place that the storm cannot penetrate to them. We had not come up out of the land of Zehemla. These our dear beloved brethren who have so dearly beloved us would still have been racked with hatred against us." Now, this is, how can you break down the barrier of hatred? This is the big problem, you see. How can we do it? Well, certainly not by making a virtue of hatred and cultivating your traditional hatred, as they do in certain countries, of course. "His brother Aaron rebuked him." He says, "Ammon, I fear that you're boasting. Are you responsible for the whole thing, racked for hatred? And said, did you turn the tide?" And Ammon said, "Oh, no. My joy is full." Notice he says here, he knows he is nothing. "I know that I am nothing." You see, this and then as a result of that, he says his joy is full. Because knowing you are nothing, as Mosiah tells us in Mosiah 4:11, "Do this and you'll always be happy," he says. "You'll always feel to rejoice," because that removes the great burden of ego, so we can turn our attention away from this image of invidiousness and conspicuous consumption and competitiveness, which frees you to deal with and enjoy reality, because all that other stuff is phony, you see. To say, what is my rank, what is my position, how do I look, and so forth. That has nothing to do with it. That's ridiculous. But when you free yourself from all that and realize that you're nothing, then he says you can afford the luxury of being happier, which is very nice. The pains of hell, and then notice, as we're told, they went back to the law of Moses. So when he says, "Sing the song of redeeming love," that was a very important part in the cult of Moses. When the people all came together, they would sing the song of redeeming love. And it was part of the ritual, an article coming out of that. "Sing the song of redeeming one, and because of the word of his power which is in us, therefore have we not great reason to rejoice. Yea, they were encircled about by everlasting darkness." It's true it was everlasting darkness. We all are until we accept the gospel. What have you to look forward to here? Remember the most famous ode on the subject, Catullus' fifth ode on the subject? Amamus mea lesbiatque vivamus. Let's make love and live, my lesbian. He says, says Catullus, "Rumoresque sanus aviriorum unius asifestimamus." let us take the criticism, the traditions, the strict moral laws and so forth of the seniorum of our strict elders. Don't take them seriously. Consider them worth one penny, he says. Soles occident et redire possunt. The sun goes down and the sun comes up again. Nobis cum semel occident brevis lux. But once our brief candle has gone out, un est perpetua nox dormi ende. Nothing remains but a perpetual night of eternal blackness. That's what you are. If you don't accept the gospel, if you don't believe that, what do you have to await but a night of eternal blackness? He said, we're surrounded, as Shakespeare says, remember, we are the stuff the dreams are made of, and our little life is surrounded with a sleep. We're asleep before we came, blackness, no memory, no nothing. Sleep after we get here, after we leave, no messing. We're surrounded by darkness, complete blackness on all sides. So Catullus expresses it very beautifully. What's his solution? He says his wild sex is the only thing why you can get it. Da mihi milia basia, da inde kentum, and give me 1,000 kisses, then give me 100 more, and we'll really get at it. And this is the only answer, because it's a desperate situation, you see. Nobis semel cum occidit brevis lis. Once our breach flight has gone down, una est perpetua nox dormienda. It's just one night perpetual sleep. And so this is literally true what he says. See, people do live in that condition if they don't have the gospel. When he says they were encircled about by everlasting darkness. Both sides of us, there's the darkness. See. Therefore, let us glory. We'll glory in the Lord, for our joy is full, because you've done away with that. I cannot say the smallest part which I feel. This is pure joy. You see, this is charity, what you call charity, which is cheer. Our word cheer is the same as charity. Cheer, charity, charis, gratia, Latin gratia, and so forth. It's no mental reservations, no gnawing discontent, no vaulting ambition. These are the seeds of tragedy, you see. If you have to have your success here in the world, and this is the only place you can get it, then you have the making of a tragedy. In the first place, because you're going to have to do some immoral things to get there. In the second place, because you're going to be disappointed. Every tragedy ends in death. Well, sooner or later it will. Remember the terrible fix that Oedipus finds himself in? Well, the chorus in the Oedipus Colonus, the second play, says, you think Oedipus has it bad? He says, but it's just the same punishment you're going to get. You're just going to be nothing after all. He says, you're being punished. Oedipus, for his crime, is being punished no more than you're being punished. Because we're all going to the same place, you see. But it turns out Oedipus does go into the next world, and he goes through the ordinances, he goes into the temple and so forth, and the last we hear of him is when the messenger reports, and Theseus reports how he sees him go into the distance, and he says he wasn't allowed to go beyond the veil. If he'd gone beyond the veil, he would have seen much more things, but he thinks, oh, they're great things. So, Sophocles, of course, was a priest himself and a very devout man, as well as the greatest playwright who ever lived. And he has given us that picture as the hope to come hereafter. Well, here we have it going here. He says he can't feel the smallest part because he's liberated from all the things that make us afraid and make us do the things that always lead to tragedy. He did not exercise his justice upon us. He says, where it fleeth at the thought, my soul fleeth at the thought, because we didn't suffer the way we deserve to suffer. But his great mercy has brought us over that everlasting gulf of death. That's the big one, you see. This is the only thing men always really fear. That's why they live in quiet desperation, because that's what they're looking at the end of their careers. Their careers are going to take a downturn before long, and so forth. Present dangers and inconveniences can be dealt with very easily because they're merely temporary. We can get along with them very nicely, but that's not the big unpleasantness. The idea. Remember Eliot's immortal lines, T.S. Eliot's immortal lines. I have seen the immortal footman hold my coat and snicker, and in short, I was afraid. Here's the immortal coatman holding his coat. It's time to go now, Buster. And he snickers, and in short, I was afraid. See, all scared to death. Because this is in the end. Don't think you can face it down because nobody's ever done it. Well, the defiant characters, all Macbeth and so forth, but theirs are the cruelest ends of all. And there he says, I say unto you that there is none that knoweth these things. Now, am I talking over your heads, he says, these things? Do you think I'm crazy because I'm rejoicing in all this? He says, no. Only the penitent know these things. You'll never rejoice unless you because it's your guilt feelings, as Freud says. It's the guilt feelings that keeps you from being happy after all. It gives you, they're suppressed. You don't, you have to bring them out to get them out into the open. He says it's not a very good cure, actually. But there are the things that give you the skin rashes and the ulcers and things like that. The guilt that you know is there, but you try to keep down. You think you've forgotten, but you haven't. It's going to haunt you all the time. So he says we get rid of all this, and we haven't been punished as we deserve to be punished, but it's wonderful, he says. But you'll never know these things unless you repent. Completely aware of how wrong they are. Here they believe a thing that makes them desperately sorrowful, that makes them absolutely miserable. And the funny thing is, if you only knew how wrong you were, you don't have to be miserable, because you're not right. That's not what comes after at all. It's not darkness. You wouldn't have come out of nothing in the first place. So, yea, he that repenteth and exerciseth faith and bringeth works and prayeth continually without ceasing unto such is given to know the mysteries of God, which never have been revealed. What is the mystery here? Now, do you remember, brother? Now he starts telling about his mission here. Do you remember? He had a plan for to going out and convert these people. We said to our brethren in the land of Zarahemla, 23, we'll go up to the land of Nephi to preach to our brethren the Lamanites. Well, they laughed their heads off. The funniest thing they ever heard of. They laughed us to scorn, he said. Convert those characters? This is what they said. For they said to us, do you suppose you can bring the Lamanites to a knowledge of the truth? Do you suppose that you can convince the Lamanites of the incorrectness of their traditions of their fathers, in which they firmly believe? As stiff-necked a people as they are, whose hearts delight in the shedding of blood, whose days have been spent in the grossest iniquity, whose ways have been the ways of the transgressor from the beginning. Now, my brethren, you remember this was their language. They're worse than communists. I mean, these people are unthinkably vile. How can you do it? They just laughed at the idea of going up to preach to them. You're not going to get anywhere, is what they said. Moreover, there's only one way to deal with those people. We have to get them before they get us. That's the only thing to do. Let us take up arms against them, that we may destroy them and their iniquity out of the land, lest they overrun and destroy us. This is the unanswerable argument, for war. This is it. That's what your gun is, kill or be killed. If you put yourself in that position, then you must do it. We must defend ourselves. We have how many, 2,200 nukes, something, I don't know how many, because they have only 1,800, but you've got to have more, knowing perfectly well that if we use as many as six, it'll all be over with everybody. And yet we've got hundreds, and we're accumulating thousands of them, getting eight new warheads every day, isn't it? Now, they've got a mass production going, and none of them could be used, of course. The military absolutely hate them, because they would make a hash of any strategy or tactics. You can't do anything against that sort of weapon. Moreover, you can't control it. Marvelous chapter in Clausewitz on the uncertainty of war. You can't control anything. As soon as the war starts, and I've seen this lots of times, as soon as the battle starts, the general can do nothing but walk forth, back and forth in his tent outside. He tries to get somebody on the wire. Nobody. All the connections are broken. Nobody knows what's going on anywhere. As soon as the shooting starts, everything it dissolves. And not our modern technology does not overcome that difficulty. It only makes it worse. As you know, how easily a computer can go out, and how easy it can be misinterpreted, and how easy you can hit the wrong key. A little while ago, Pat hit the wrong key on the computer, and we lost a whole week's work, dictating and so forth. This can happen. And of course, in the fluster and hurry and excitement of war, it's going to happen. It happens all the time. Everybody makes the wrong thing, because I had to make reports every day. I had to go and be around, interview prisoners of war, try to find out what was going on and so forth, and make a sensible report out of it. It was a garbled mess all the time. Once in a while did it work, though, but oh boy. And this is what he's talking about here, this absurdity. But this was the answer they gave. We must destroy them before they destroy us. And that's unanswerable, we say, because they're dangerous. They're a threat. Ammon has the answer to that. Behold, my beloved brethren, we came into the wilderness not with the intent to destroy our brethren. Now notice this. It's a gamble as far as he's concerned. Of course, all war is a gamble too. It's a gamble, but he says it's worth it. That perhaps we might save some few of their souls. He hasn't great hopes in going there. It's not a sure deal at all. Perhaps we might, it's just possible, save, well, a few of them. It's worth all this trouble just to save a few of them. That's quite a bargain, quite an exchange when you start figuring out the chances and the expense and all this sort of thing. And so, now, our hearts were depressed, and we were about to turn back, because they weren't getting anywhere at all. They met what they thought they would. Things looked very bleak when they got there. And behold, we have come and been forth amongst them, and we have been patient. They went back again. And because, knows the Lord comforted us and said, go amongst the Lamanites, and bear with patience thine afflictions. And this is what the mightiest warrior in the Book of Mormon had to put up with. He had been patient in our suffering. We have suffered every privation. We have traveled from house to house and let the people kick us around, relying on the mercies of the world, not upon the mercies of the world alone, but upon the mercies of God. Brother Benson's speech was on pride. This man had no pride at all. I mean, the mighty Ammon going around begging, as it were, from door to door, relying on the mercies of the world and the people. And we have been cast out and mocked and spit upon. I wouldn't take a chance spitting on Ammon. Smote upon our cheeks, but he allowed it. Why? And all this, no, he goes on, he's saying, smote upon our cheeks, and we have been stoned, and we have bound with strong cords and cast into prison. Why did he allow all this to happen? He says, all manner of affliction, and all this, that perhaps we might be able to save some soul. That's the gamble right there, you see. It was worth it, you see. Well, is it worth the chance? And we suppose that our joy would be full if perhaps we could be the means of saving some. Pascal's famous proposition, you know, his famous proposition. Is it worth practicing self-control and Christian virtues and so forth just on the chance that there might be a hereafter, that you might live forever, you might have eternal life? It's not proven at all. It's just a chance. It's just a gamble. Is it worth making the trouble? Well, he says, of course it's worth making the trouble. If you win, you win everything. And if you lose, you don't lose anything, because nobody's expecting anything anyway. You can't lose as far as he goes. So bet on it by all means, he says. Go that way, because when you win, you stand to win it all. If you go the other way, you know you'll lose, and you've already lost as far as that goes. So you have nothing to win. So Pascal's famous proposition is put forth here to the brethren. Perhaps we might save some soul. There might be a chance, and it's worth everything. But now we can look on the fruits of our labor. It really did work, he says. They had rather sacrifice their lives even than to take the life of their enemy. This is what he guards as his reward, his great triumph of this great warrior. And they have buried their weapons of war deep in the earth because of their love toward their brethren. That's right. And so great a love in all, have you seen so great a love in all the land? Behold, I say, not even among the Nephites will you find it. They would take up arms against their brethren, but behold how many of these have laid down their lives because of their love and their hatred to sin. Regarding that as the ultimate sin. See, they keep calling it murder, and they don't want to do that. Now, if this is boasting, he says, go ahead, I'll boast. I don't make no excuses, he says in the 36th verse here. They are a branch, we are a branch of the tree of Israel who's been lost from its body. Now, this is how they thought of themselves. They knew that they were isolated and so forth, and there have been enclaves. Always people never forget their homes that they have come from originally. There are some enclaves in Europe and Asia and so forth. The Jews being the isolated ones that never forget. And of course, all the time I was growing up and before the generation before me, all the saints felt that in the West here, we were just marking time until we could return to Jackson County, which was the real place where we should be. We should go back to Missouri. Everybody thought we'd be doing that, you know, and we may yet. But the branch of the tree lost from a body in a strange land, wanderers in a strange land, enclaves and so forth. But God is mindful. Now he gets into a universal theme, which is very important in this 37th verse here. God is mindful of every people whatsoever land they may be. Yea, he numbereth his people, and his bowels have mercy over all the earth. You can't divide the earth then into the godly and the godless, can you? Now we come to this next chapter. The Amalekites were still strong, though, and still dangerous. And they begin a movement against the people of Anti-Nephi Lehi, who had, with a government, and had taken over more or less. But the Amalekites, because of their loss, were exceeding angry. They began to stir up their brethren against the people of Anti-Nephi Lehi, and they began to destroy them. Because, remember, these various people, or members of the nation, had their districts or their states or their provinces they lived in, and they were fairly uniform, and they're going to make trouble for the king. I don't know whether they did rebel, but they were reduced, you see. Anti-Nephi, they began to destroy them. And the people still refused to take up arms. Well, and that was a pushover from them now, but now they were really mad about it, the Anti-Nephi Lehi peoples. And then we're told here, when Ammon saw this great work of destruction, they were moved to compassion. They had to do something about it. And he says, Ammon says, well, let's get the people together and clear out here and go to the land of Zarahemla. Now, this evacuation of villages is very common. I say, in the history of the Pueblos, Southwest Indians, whose villages are very ancient and stable, nevertheless, again and again, they evacuate a village and move to another place because of hard feelings or because of war or because of dangers from something else. This constant movement between the villages and the tribes, and this he wants to suggest, well, we've had plenty of them in the Book of Mormon. He called that the Rechabite principle. See, Jonadab ben Rechab leads the people out away from the wicked world they're in, so they can be in the desert by themselves and worship the Lord as they please. Dead Sea Scrolls, that's what we have there. And that's what we have here. Let us go down to the land of Zarahemla. Let us flee out of the hands of our enemies. They got to do, since we won't fight them, we better run away from them. But the king said unto the Nephites, behold, we deserve what we're getting because of the many murders and sins we have committed against them. See, there you are again, war is murder. And we're willing to be their slaves, he said. Boy, they're really, he has it bad. Until we repair unto them the murders and sins we have committed against them. The 8th verse here. Notice, regardless of the fact that they were killing mutually and reciprocally in the battlefield, it was a murder against the enemy. But Ammon said to them, nope. Said unto him, it is against the law of our brethren there should be any slavery at all, so we can't be their slaves. Our only alternative is to submit to them, and then we'd be their slaves. But Ammon says it's against the law of Moses, that Israelites should be made slaves. It can't be, you see. So we can't do it. We've got to get out. So the voice of the Lord came to Ammon and said, get out. And the people get out of the land, and they perish not. There's another one of those migrations. Satan has great hold on the Amalekites. They do stir up the Lamanites to anger against their brethren to slay them. So they gathered the people together. Here's the 14th verse, the usual procedure, all their lands, all the people of the Lord to gather together, all the flocks and herds. He says, this is extravagant. Remember, this is 1828-29 before the church was founded, but this is exactly what the Mormons did, wasn't it? They did it. They went from New York, they went to Ohio, they went to Ohio to Missouri, Missouri to Ohio, Ohio to Missouri, Missouri to Jackson County to the Valley, always gathering everything they had and getting out. They had to take everything they with them and move, and that's what they did. Some of the wagons, trains crossing the plains must have been enormously impressive. When you'd see hundreds of wagons, not just a strain of 5 or 6, 10 wagons, looks like something big in the movies. But when you get hundreds of them strung along, it must be a terrific thing. And that's what they had, some of the big companies, one company following another. So they went into the wilderness, which divided the land of Nephi from the land of Zarahemla, and came over near the border. But where are they going to settle? And it was all the good land was taken already. And they were relieved, fortunately, because as they were making the journey, Ammon was going to Zarahemla to ask for permission to do something. And he met Alma and the missionaries returning from their labors. There was a great rejoicing. The joy of Ammon was full, even to exhausting of his strength. He fell to earth. He was so overcome. This was a passionate person, this Ammon. But of course, this is proskinesis, this falling to the earth. I say this is another ancient custom that we don't have today. A salam, the knees bend over. When you fall on your knees and bend over, that's a common salute in certain countries to a person. And this is what happens. He fell to the earth again, which is what you do, you see, when you're overwhelmed in the presence of God or a great man like Alma or something like that. Behold their joy to exceed their strength in his passionation. Alma conducted his brethren back to the land of Zarahemla, even to his own house. Now, the brethren stayed at his house, but meantime they're going to make negotiations to see if they can't get these people of Ammon who wouldn't fight, the Anti-Nephi-Lehi people they were, get them settled somewhere, and they find a place for them. They form a buffer state in the land Jershon. Some of you may have been to Jerash. Jerash has now become, just recently they've made it, I was there many years ago, they make it, it is on the border between Jordan and Syria. And it is a magnificently preserved city, a perfectly preserved Roman city, I mean, with all its splendors, public arts, the long, long main street, the shop fronts and so forth, and the pillars, and then the fountain here, and then a perfectly beautifully preserved amphitheater and so forth. It was neglected completely. Nobody was out there. It was just in the desert. Now it's been made a Sony Lumiere affair, you see, one of these where they put on a show, and the tourists go out in buses and so forth and so on. But it's Jerash, it's called, which is the same name, Jershon, the border town, see, Jerash, and they put them in a border country called Jershon, and it makes a buffer state. See, they don't have to fight, but they're a buffer, and they supply grain and other necessities to the Nephites, and the Nephites give them protection there. It's a good arrangement for both of them. They fix it up here very nicely. We will give up the land of Jershon for an inheritance, and we'll protect our brethren in the land of Jershon, You know, the Jews have had settlements out here in the West, too. Not if you ever heard of Clarion. You know, they settled back in the beginning of the 20th century. They were going to found a new Jerusalem at Clarion, a place called Clarion on the border between Utah and Nevada out there by Baker. And, of course, it disappeared completely. None of these things settled, but there were many attempts to settle like that by the Jews and others. Jung Stilling, some very famous cases of Quaker settlements. Massachusetts Bay, Pennsylvania. Jerash was one of that sort of thing, you see, for an inheritance. So they said, and we'll protect them there while they get supplies to us, give us supplies. And this because great fear came upon them because of the sore repentance which they had on account, here it is again, 23rd verse, on account of the many murders and their awful wickedness. Well, isn't all fair in war? That they may inherit the land of Jericho is going to be theirs. We will guard them, and they will give us a portion of their substance to assist us that we may maintain our armies. Well, that's fair, a fair operation then. So they settled down and took to that. And they were these people that settled there were absolutely ideal. I guess something like the Amish that you find in Pennsylvania or the Duke of Ors. Perfectly honest and upright, they did look upon the shedding of blood with the greatest importance. It doesn't depend on whose blood either. They never did look upon death with any degree of terror for themselves, as far as that goes. And so, we get to the next chapter. Well, I've got to move along here. Let's see how much time we have for. Oh boy, time is up. Well, at least we got that far. But we're going to get to this very important chapter 30. This is extremely important, and the rest, 62 chapters to Alma. We're going to have to move right along. But probably able to do it. If it gets into sort of a uniformity here, in chapter 28, see the Lamanites keep up the pressure at a high price to themselves. There's a general conservation, lots of bloodshed, this 28th chapter. See, then we get a picture of confused war, you see. And let us be true to one another, for the world that seems to lie around us. Remember what we're living in today, Dover Beach. Matthew Arnold's great poem, for the world that seems to lie about us like a land of dreams, so beautiful, so various, so new, is really without life nor joy nor love nor certitude nor peace nor help for pain. But we are here as in a darkling plain, swept by confused alarms of struggle and of flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. That's the situation of the world as it was before World War I when you wrote that. So there's still a situation where ignorant armies clashed by night. And believe me, they're ignorant.